This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Election season in Zimbabwe, election time in Zimbabwe, they can be a very hot one where, you know, emotions, political emotions go really high. And, the preparation itself, it starts a couple of months or even years.
That was Elliot Masote, a professor of business at Devery University, speaking about Zimbabwe's elections. Details coming up. Also, ECOWAS military commanders discuss the next steps in resolving the Niger crisis. And Kenyans turn to food banks to fight hunger. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. In Ghana today, West African military chiefs discussed a possible armed intervention to reverse last month's coup in Niger. Alarmed by a series of military takeovers in the region, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has agreed to activate a standby force to restore constitutional order in Niger. ECOWAS demands that Niger's coup leaders release President Mahamud Bazoum, warning that the bloc could send in troops if negotiations fail. The two-day meeting will conclude tomorrow when the defense chiefs are expected to announce any next steps. Russia and the United States have urged their diplomatic solution to the crisis. ECOWAS has applied trade and financial sanctions, while France, Germany, and the United States have suspended aid programs. Germany today said it wants the EU to impose sanctions on coup leaders. Jihadist insurgencies have gripped Africa's Sahel region for more than a decade, breaking out in northern Mali in 2012 before spreading to neighboring Niger and Burkina Faso in 2015. The violence and instability has led to coup d'etats in Mali and Burkina Faso. An African affairs expert says one way of finding a solution to the crisis in Niger is to use soft power influence. He says such influence includes using religious leaders to open grounds for negotiations between the military junta in Niger and sub-regional group ECOWAS and the African Union. Christopher Isiki is a professor of African politics and international relations at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He says using soft power will help prevent the use of military force that ECOWAS has threatened. Isiki spoke to reporter Mike Mboni about the Niger crisis. He says one resolution that will work for all parties is to initiate an election timetable that will return Niger's republic to civil rule within 12 months.
There are options for an amicable solution to the Niger crisis, despite the initial forceful approach that was taken by the ECOWAS. Now, one of such options is the use of soft power influencers, such as religious leaders, to thaw the ice and open grounds for dialogue between ECOWAS, the African Union, and the military regime in Niger. This has already been encouraged, and given the ethno-regional and religious connections between states in the region, I am positive that they will impact positively to prevent the military option that was threatened by ECOWAS initially. One resolution that would likely work for all the parties would be for an election timetable to return Niger to democratic rule within 12 months and for Bazoum to be eligible to contest that election.
The junta in Niger Republic seems comfortable negotiating with religious leaders or groups from Nigeria. Do you think such leaders should be co-opted by the regional group, ECOWAS, or Africa Union to negotiate?
Well, I think we are already seeing some traction from the involvement of religious leaders from Nigeria. As I said earlier, the two outcomes so far from their engagement are, one, the junta agreed to meet them, and this is a big shift as previous mediators were unable to see the top leadership of the junta. Two, after their meeting, the junta agreed to talk to ECOWAS. So yes, I would suggest their involvement beyond breaking the ice to actual involvement in the negotiations, which should be about restoring democratic rule in the shortest possible time in Niger.
The junta says they will try President Mohamed Bazoum for high treason. What's your take on this?
I think the junta may be trying to use this as a bargaining chip, you know, to get some leverage for themselves, because although they have the power to do this militarily, having already suspended the constitution, it will be a tough ask to legitimately prove this without indicting themselves. You know, first, the head of the junta, Chiani, has been involved at the highest level of governance in Niger in the last decade or so, and that raises the question of what point or part of the government actions under the previous administration and Bazoum's administration are treasonable, which are not, and how will he extricate himself, for instance. And then second, talking about treason, the military takeover of power itself is treasonable, even in a country like Niger with a history of coups. And third, if they go ahead with it, then it's a fate, which also indicates that they intend to stay in power for a long time. Now, this will be sad, as the history of military regimes in West Africa show that the military oftentimes end up more, actually worse than the civilians that they overthrew. And I don't see how this particular one, you know, would be different.
What is a long-term solution to military takeover or coup in Africa, and to avert interventions witnessed in some African states?
We need to rethink the concept of state and governance. We need to reinvent Africa. The military intervention in politics in the continent is a reflection of the failure of state and governance. And this failure is rooted in perverse state formation and the perverse notions and understandings of governance that it produced. The state in Africa was not established as a development machine in the same way as it was established in Europe and America, for instance. The state in Africa was established precisely to exploit Africa and its people and its resources. And when the colonialists left, we did not interrogate this state that we inherited. We need to interrogate those states, and we need to repurpose them to make them more meaningful, you know, for our developmental needs. And that will produce new understandings of governance and the kind of political systems, the kind of democracy, such as social democracy, one that works for people, one that will expand in public works and public good and development for the people.
Christopher Isiki is a professor of African politics and international relations at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. He spoke to journalist Mike Mbonye by phone from Pretoria. Elliot Masote is a professor of business at DeVry University in Ohio. He just returned from an extended visit to Harare a few weeks ago. He says people are excited about the upcoming election in Zimbabwe. In the first part of my conversation with the professor, he talks about the differences between ZANU-PF's Emmerson Mnangagwa, the incumbent, and his challenger, the Citizens Coalition for Change's candidate, Nelson Chamisa. First, he starts by describing how Zimbabwe's presidential and parliamentary election system functions and how it is perceived by the citizens.
Well, these are called harmonized elections that are done every 5 years. And, they include local authorities and, councillors from the rural areas all the way to the cities, the members of parliament, and senators all the way to presidential elections. So it's a very big election season in Zimbabwe, election time in Zimbabwe. They can be a very hot one where, political emotions go really high. And, the preparation itself, it starts a couple of months or even years before then, from individual political parties trying to choose who is going to represent them when it gets to harmonized elections. So there are conflicts that can be found in both parties and between political parties as well in preparation for such, a huge election in a country like Zimbabwe.
So it's something very big. But another thing I noticed is it's also very expensive. Presidential candidates forking out, what, $20,000 to appear on the ballot, and parliamentary candidates pay about $2,000.
Yeah, it's really much expensive, and it shows that those with such type of money are the ones who are always going to, to win. And they're always going to afford that type of money, afford also expenses in campaigning, even if they do not have leadership qualities, which means, such a political landscape may, is likely not to be fair, because it leaves the poor people who may be talented in leadership. So if you don't have money, even if you are talented, even if people like you are not going to have the chance to contest elections. And that puts, some question marks on what type of democracy can that be when it is charged for one to contest elections, unlike previous elections where it was free for anybody to be on the ballot as long as you are going to have certain number of signatures when you file your interest to contest political parties. So it's a concern, and hopefully it's going to be addressed so that not only those with such type of money will be able to contest, but opening up, the political landscape to everybody.
So money is a way of filtering out the poorer.
Exactly. And that puts question marks on the type of democracy that it can be called a false democracy then. It doesn't involve everybody. It involves only those with money to be the ruling class and those without money to always be ruled.
So let's talk about the leading candidates, ZANU PF's Emmerson Mnangagwa, the incumbent, Citizens Coalition for Change's Nelson Chamisa, front runners. Talk to us about these two leading candidates.
Yeah, these are, totally different opposite candidates looking at their ages as well. President Mnangagwa is over 8 years old, and Chamisa is in his 40s, and the experience is also different, even though both of them are lawyers. But, looking at who is who here, Chamisa is so popular with the young people who are unemployed, who are, appealing to somebody who is close to them in terms of age, somebody who is close to them in terms of feeling the impact of such type of tough economy on people. And they have lost trust in the old guard who have been in power ever since 1980. And so the young people feel disconnected to the old political parties, ZANU-PF and its old candidate as well. And, there are some vote buying, but looking at Chamisa himself, he's coming from a fractured opposition party landscape where that can weaken him. And ZANU-PF seem to be kind of united and with a message that a country is built by its owners. When we look at President Chamisa, he's just talking about the poor economy that has been in that state and maybe getting worse for some people for a number of years, but he's failing really to say how.
That was Elliot Masote, a professor of business at DeVry University. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of Ohio. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the Voice of America. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. With the growing impact of droughts caused by climate change and high food prices exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, food banks are emerging as a growing solution to hunger and poverty in Africa. A nonprofit group in Nairobi, Food Banking Kenya, distributed more than 500,000 kilograms of food last year to hungry families. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's Poverty Report 2021 released by the Kenya National Bureau of Statistics showed that 19 million Kenyans, about 38% of the population, live in poverty. One in three living in rural areas and one in four living in urban areas cannot meet their food needs. Mishrin Polonyua of Nairobi is one of those in need. She says she has slept many nights hungry with her two children. She says, I'm pushing on with this difficult life. I wish I had a job to do, but I don't have one. Food is expensive, she says. If you get 200 shillings, you cannot afford to buy a packet of maize flour. Volonia is among more than 50 people who receive dry food and vegetables on this day, enough to last a few days. Due to high food prices and a lack of employment opportunities, millions of Kenyans struggled to feed their families. Food Bank in Kenya was established in 2016 and collects food from large and small-scale farmers, exporters, supermarkets and other retailers. The organization's reach has expanded as the need for food increases. John Kathungu is the head of Food Bank in Kenya.
In the year 2022, we were able to give out to our beneficiaries, the very vulnerable people in the society, almost 500,000 kilos of food. To date, as we speak, in this August, we are able to donate out to our beneficiaries or give out what we have to our beneficiaries to a maximum of over 3,000 kilos every day.
The organization has three distribution centers in Nairobi. People running homes for the elderly, teenage mothers and children come to this warehouse at least twice a month to collect food to keep the homes running and the vulnerable safe. Florence Mbai, director of the Fountain of Life Children's Home, is one who uses the food bank.
There are other ways of getting food, but this food has been very useful to us. Since we knew them, they have been helping us getting food. So they cannot call us and we refuse to come food. And we don't have food right now. The food in Kenya, life in Kenya has become very expensive and getting food is not cheap.
Peter Kamau of the Destiny Rescue Center is another food bank customer.
We rely totally on donors, on organizations like Food Bank and other organizations. So without them, we'd really not be able to run the homes.
The hunger situation is expected to persist in the coming months in Kenya and elsewhere. Food Bank in Kenya has expressed its commitment to assisting those within its capacity. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
The start of the rainy season in Sudan and neighboring Chad is making it difficult to deliver aid to refugees from Sudan's war. In this report from the Chadian town of Adunur, reporter Henry Wilkins looks at some of the logistical challenges faced by those trying to deliver aid and talks to experts about how Sudan's failed planting season means a desperate food emergency could likely get even worse.
Mohamed Kames fled western Darfur, where rights groups say atrocities against civilians are taking place, around 2 months ago. He arrived in Adamor, Chad, close to the Sudan border, where he thought he would be safe. He says upon his arrival there was a sense of security and safety, but after the floods brought by the rainy season, homes were inundated and there's a severe scarcity of food. Sudan and Chad's rainy season peaks in August and September. It's making access to Adamor very difficult for aid groups. VOA was only able to reach the refugee site in these amphibious all-terrain vehicles operated by the UN. Conventional vehicles like this truck carrying food aid to Adamor become stuck in thick mud, attempts to rescue them unsuccessful. Ibrahim Mohamed Abdallah, a refugee who arrived 2 weeks ago, says the isolation in Adamor makes him frightened.
We have no security there. You know, we have no remained there alone. And even your friend totally. That's why we also came to the border of Chad. I need help. I don't want to stay there because here is also, you know, it's very dangerous, my children.
Lack of access is not the only problem the rainy season brings. Humanitarians say its arrival also marks a grim milestone for Sudan. David Del Conte is a humanitarian and policy consultant who works with aid group Refugees International.
For much of Sudan, the planting season is over. All along the River Nile would be the planting season for much of the country's staples. So the situation in Sudan is such that we have a problem today that will be much bigger tomorrow.
Khartoum and its surrounding area, which sits at the confluence of the Blue and White Nile rivers, has been rocked by fighting between the Sudanese military and the paramilitary rapid support forces, making it almost impossible for farmers to plant. To add to his woes, members of Mohamed Karmis's family are still unaccounted for. He does not know if they were able to escape Sudan, if they are alive or dead.
Specifically my aunts and brothers, we have been unable to locate them.
For the refugees of Adamawa, the unfolding tragedy, at least for the moment, has no end in sight. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Adamawa, Chad.
In Malawi, a southern African nation that criminalizes homosexuality, faith leaders have spoken out against same-sex relations, while Parliament recommends a referendum on whether to legalize same-sex marriage. Civil society organizations say human rights should not be subject to a popular vote. From the capital, Lilongwe, Chemwemwi Padata has the story.
A debate is raging in Malawi over homosexuality, a criminal offence in the southern African nation that can draw a prison sentence of up to 14 years. The faith leaders of the mostly Christian country recently led nationwide street protests prompted by high court cases in which a Dutch national man and a transgender Malawian woman are challenging the constitutionality of the country's laws concerning LGBTQI plus people. Some protesters worry that the cases might move toward validating LGBTQI plus relationships. The Reverend Philip Gambolide of the Church of Central Africa Presbyterian says marriage should be between a man and a woman.
It is God who initiated the marriage. And when God created a man, he saw it fit to create a woman to be his wife in order to reproduce and make a church. So because it is God's purpose, we cannot deviate now from his purpose. If we condone this behavior of sex homosexuality, obviously we are killing the church and there will be no children.
Faith leaders like Gambolide are now suggesting that the government should conduct a referendum over banning same-sex marriage. The International Relations Committee of Parliament has submitted a report to the governing body detailing its position on homosexuality. In this report, Parliament agrees with the religious leaders on possibilities of holding a referendum on same-sex marriages. The committee suggests that all protocols, including proposed laws concerning the LGBTQI plus community, should be put to people to decide, says Vice Chairperson Victoria Kingston.
This should be left in the hands of Parliament to deliberate and should put to people to decide in a form of referendum.
LGBTQI plus community members worry that with the increased focus on their rights, they will be targeted for violence. One member who asked not to be named for security reasons says the fear is constant.
Kind of puts us in a corner where we're not even, will be as isolated as before, more than before actually. It really has that implication. But it also limits the freedom of expression. I mean, that's a human right.
Michael Kayatsa, Executive Director of Malawi Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation, cautions against holding the referendum, which he feels.
That was Chimwemwi Padata reporting from Lilongwe. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.